want you guys to start off. We're going to go on a sacred journey tonight. Everybody close your eyes, bow your heads. Just take a few deep breaths. Back, travel with me. Go back before the United States of America. Time before Jesus Christ was even born on this earth. Go back another 1,000 years. You're sitting in Israel. You live in a small town. It's outside of the city. It's far away from the temple. It's far away from the palace. It's far away from there you know by name. They're all friends. You're young, teenage. There's one particular young woman who lives there. She's a friend of yours from school. Her name is Abishag. Wonderful character. Everybody knows her. She's good friends with everyone. Everyone thinks very high. And so her brothers and her mother and she have worked very hard to sustain a living to provide for themselves. She works outside. Her skin is very dark and tan from hard labor. Her arms are strong. Her eyes are dark and her hair is just jet black and glistens in the sun. Her brothers are like most other brothers. They force her to work hard and sometimes give her a difficult time. She hasn't had an easy life, but as a result of her trials, she has great character and she's beautiful both inside and out. You're a friend of hers, and on this particular day, something amazing is happening for this small village. Well, she was quite young, an early teenager. King David took sick in the city far away. And so they chose her as the choicest virgin in all the land to come and to care for the king. And while she was there, his son Solomon spotted her, developed a friendship with her, and fell passionately in love with her. All the women in the kingdom were jealous of her because this simple country girl, without even trying, has stolen the heart of the king. And so now today is her wedding day. Being a good friend of hers, you're sitting in her home, in her living room, with her and her mother and her brothers. You and some of her close friends are there to celebrate, and it's an exciting time. In this small country village, not much happens. And the king is coming to visit. He's coming to pick up his bride. You're sitting in the living room with Abishag. She looks absolutely gorgeous. She's dressed in white. She didn't put her hair up because Solomon likes it down. She has long, jet black hair down to her shoulders. She's wise enough to carry herself with dignity, but she's just young enough that she giggles and she's a little nervous. And as you're talking and waiting to see what will happen for this great wedding day, you're looking out the window and you see Solomon. And he's coming to take her and to make her his bride. You can open your eyes. Here's what she says, looking through. Here's what she says. Looking through the window, she sees him. Look, who is this? Coming up from the desert like a column of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and incense, made from the spices of the merchant. And so sitting in her poor country home, far removed from the city, she's waiting for Solomon to come and take her. Custom would have been in this culture for the woman who lived out in the country to be prepared for the wedding and for the groom to come all the way out and to take her and to bring her into the city palace where they would become husband and wife. And so she's sitting in her living room waiting. She's anticipating getting married. It's such an exciting day. And as she looks out the window, she sees a large plume of smoke from all of the entourage that travels with Solomon. Probably at the front and the back, there were people carrying incense wafters. There would have been a lot of pomp and ceremony and circumstance. In the dryness of the desert, there undoubtedly was a great deal of dust that surrounded them. So as they're coming up, she can see them far off in the distance from her country home. And she's very, very excited and anticipating. She says, it is Solomon's carriage, escorted by 60 warriors, the noblest of Israel, all of them wearing the sword, and all of them experienced in battle, each with his sword at his side, prepared for the terrors of the night. And let me ask you this. What's the biggest wedding you've ever seen, the highest number of groomsmen and bridesmaids? How big is a big wedding? 5, pretty good size. 10 is about the biggest I've ever seen. It's got, essentially, here, 60 groomsmen. He's got this entire posse bringing up the rear. Jewish posse, true story. all of them warriors strapped with a sword. Imagine this coming of the king out into this remote village where he's been courting his bride. Solomon is being carried on a throne that was inlaid with gold, and the warriors would have carried him on their shoulders. They're traveling miles out into the wilderness. This is what she sees coming. King Solomon made for himself the carriage. He made it of wood from Lebanon, which is the choicest, the finest of wood. He made its posts, he made of silver, its base of gold, its seat was upholstered with purple, its interior lovingly inlaid by the daughters of Jerusalem. And so this throne is extravagant. Purple was the color of kings. It would have taken a tremendous amount of money to even get enough dye to make a purple garment. And in addition, this throne is inlaid possibly with poetry and with flowers and decoration from other people that were friends of the family and such, helped decorate this throne. And so if you can get this picture in your mind, this simple, hardworking, middle-class, poor working girl lives out in the country. The king falls in love with her. It's the wedding day. Here he comes. She can see him coming off in the distance. Probably all of the friends and family and all of the kids in the neighborhood are lining the streets, just waiting to see this fantastic day. They would have, he's going out to pick up his bride, and what they would have done for her is they would have had a large reclining couch, and she would have come out fully dressed, beautiful, ready for her wedding. She would have laid on the couch, the men would have picked her up, put her on their shoulders, and carried her with Solomon into the city. So he's being transported on the throne, and she's being transported on the couch. Solomon's smooth. This is not some guy at a Honda Accord driving down to Reno. He's thought this through. So he's coming up. She's all excited. She can see him. It's her wedding day. She's anticipating being with him. She says, "Come out, you daughters of Zion." She's pretty proud about her husband, and she's pretty excited for her wedding day. And the celebration is public, and she is not ashamed. She can't wait to show off her husband. And look at King Solomon wearing the crown. The crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day his heart rejoiced. And so he's wearing this enormous crown that his mother Bathsheba gave to him as a wedding present. And so here he comes. He's coming to get her. And it's a beautiful thing because we see biblically here and throughout the scriptures that a husband takes a wife and a woman is given in marriage. Abishag, as we've seen throughout the book, is not running after Solomon. He is courting her. She's inviting him to court her. She maintains her dignity. She maintains her respect. She maintains her value. And even to this point, if Solomon wants her to be married, he has to come and get her. She commands a certain amount of dignity and respect. And you think, gosh, couldn't the king of Israel send 60 of these groomsmen out to pick up the bride and bring her into the city? They're all carrying the sword to protect her because he wants to honor her. He wants to make sure that she's safe. He comes out personally to pick up his bride. That's how important she is to him. So she's a treasured jewel to him. He cares about her very deeply. So then, that's Abishag's words. She speaks. She speaks first. We've seen that a lot throughout this book, that she speaks first in chapter 1. And she speaks last at the end of the book. She is a strong, passionate, secure, confident woman who maintains her dignity while still being feminine. She has this wonderful balance. And so Solomon responds to her. He's now come up to the house, and now he sees his bride. "How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful." Twice he tells her that she's beautiful to reassure her how precious she is in his sight. First words out of his mouth are talking about her beauty and the fact that he considers her his darling. "Your eyes behind your veil are doves." So she's got a small veil on. Behind that, he can see her eyes. And doves are always a symbol of purity and of peace and of blessing. But in addition, doves, as we've studied, have one faithful partner throughout the course of their life. And so in calling her eyes doves, He's also speaking of her purity and of her loyalty, that her intentions are focused exclusively on Him alone. Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from Mount Gilead, which at first glance, most women, when compared to a goat, would not be flattered. But she's a country girl. She lives out in the country. She works with her hands. And so to her, this would have made perfect sense. If you can think about it, an enormous hill with a large flock of goats all descending down the hill. All of them clean with shiny jet black coats, traveling in such an enormous herd, you can't even see ground between them. Coming down the side of the hill, it looks like a mane of jet black hair that's sort of wavy and moving. He's slick. Solomon's sharp. Take lessons, gentlemen. The reason he got a good woman is because he knew how to speak to her. He knew how to honor her. He knew how to treat her with dignity. He won her favor. He's wonderful with his words. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep just shorn, coming up from the washing. Each has its twin. None of them is alone. So he started with her eyes. Now he's moving down. Talks about her teeth. He's picking out specific things in her appearance. Gentlemen, it's not good enough just to tell a woman, you're pretty. You need to be a little more specific than that. Solomon starts to pick out things in his bride's appearance that he finds lovely and attractive in her. He says now that her teeth, they're white. And apparently in this culture, to have all of your teeth was a really big deal. And so he's pretty stoked that he doesn't have some wife who looks like she's working a part-time job as a boxing instructor. She has all of her teeth, and they're all white. And to him, that's a very nice situation. He compares her to a flock of sheep coming up from their washing. The sheep, fresh from getting washed, would have clean, white, glistening coats, and that's the way her teeth look. So far, so good. Your lips are like a scarlet ribbon. Your mouth is lovely. And so here we've got this unkept country beauty, and now she's wearing lipstick in her. He's looking at her lips, and possibly for one of the first times he's seen them actually adorned and decorated with lipstick. And he just talks about how beautiful it is to see her lips. Goes on. Your temples behind your veil are like the halves of the pomegranate. And probably temples isn't the best translation there if you've got the NIV. Some of the other translations will say your cheeks. And he tells her your cheeks are like pomegranates, that they're red. And possibly the issue here is I think that maybe she's blushing. She's getting married. She's going to be a wife. For the first time in her life, she's going to have intercourse. The king has just paraded into her village to get her. Everyone's looking at her. She's the center of attention. They're going to carry her out on a couch. Everybody's going to be lining the streets just to honor her. And I think the issue is here that her cheeks are red. She's blushing. She still has this sense of dignity, and even though she's secured, there's still just this little bit of modesty about her. She knows how to carry herself. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with elegance, and on it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Most likely this tower was created by stacking large rocks one on top of another, and to Solomon, this tower, was built by his father, and was most likely a lookout point of safety to provide for Israel and to protect them in times of battle against enemies that might come in and seek to harm the people and to destroy the city. And so Solomon says that to him, her neck is like that. It brings him security. It brings him confidence. It brings him safety. He finds her to be powerful and a source of great rest. And he says, on it hang shields. And what would have happened on this large tower is that they would have taken the shields of the warriors and they would have encircled this entire tower so that if anybody laid siege against it, there would be some defense for it. And he says in the same way, she somehow has this necklace on that is having the same effect. It's probably multiply layered and her entire neck is adorned with some sort of necklace. And so he talks about how beautiful her eyes look, her cheeks, her neck, her lips. He's speaking to her very, very specifically. Your two breasts are like two fawns. So he continues his southward journey. Like twin fawns of a gazelle that browse among the lilies. And you think here, your two breasts are like two fawns. Harry? What's he talking about? Your breasts are like two fawns. Two small, possibly 2 foot tall baby deer. I'll tell you what my guess is. If you've ever been to the zoo, they've usually got a petting section. And what is in the petting section? The small animals, right? The baby animals. A fawn would be in there. Why? What happens when you see a baby animal? You want to pet it. You want to touch it. They're fun to play with. I think that's where he's going. As I preach this book, I just continue to tell myself, all scripture is God-breathed. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee, I will go to the mountain of myrrh, to the hill of incense. So Solomon here is reassuring her, tonight, we don't have to break off our date. It's very frustrating when you're dating to have a wonderful romantic evening together, to be passionately in love, and then to take your fiancé home and leave them, and then go home all by yourself. My wife and I dated for almost 5 years. I can attest, it is frustrating, and it's very difficult when you love someone not to be able to spend the evening with them, not just sexually, but just to be together, to have your entire life integrated so that you're a couple. And so he tells her, until the shadows break, until the sun comes up in the morning, I am going to be with you. So now he's starting to speak about their night together, about their honeymoon. Wonderful. All beautiful you are, my darling, there is no flaw in you. We saw earlier that she was insecure in her appearance. She says, I am the rose of Sharon. I'm just one of the lilies of the valley. I look like every other woman. There's nothing particularly exciting about me. There's nothing particularly breathtaking. So he tells her, there is no flaw in you. He reassures her that, and you can think, here's this young woman, for the first time, after they get married, he's going to see her naked. She's going to be undressed before him. She probably has a great deal of insecurity, uncertain about what he might think. Is he going to like what he sees? Is he going to find me attractive? And Solomon has just told her how beautiful he finds her. And then he reassures her by saying, my darling, there is no flaw in you. He reassures her. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Descend from the crest of Amana, from the top of Sinir, the summit of Hermon, from the lion's dens and the mountain haunts of the leopards. And so he is inviting her to leave her country home, to leave her home out in the wilderness, and to come into the city and to marry him and to be the bride of the king. And then he says, you have stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You have stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. And so in calling her his sister, it's just a very personal, warm, affectionate way to speak to her. My sister, my bride. It's like my lover and my friend. You have stolen my heart. He absolutely is ravished with this woman. He loves her dearly. And as he looks at her, he's just sort of overwhelmed with her beauty on this great day. And I tell you, a woman is never as beautiful as on her wedding day. To see your wife dressed to be your bride, it's just breathtaking. It's wonderful. And that's what Solomon's experiencing. There's just this glow about his young bride. He's so happy to see her. And so I think at this point, things transitioned to the city and they were married. And we don't have a lot of great detail about the wedding ceremony. And then we transition into the honeymoon night. And it's amazing to me that the Bible would touch on something this sacred and this delicate. But what it does is it shows sexuality in a way that it belongs to God and it's sacred. And when done within a covenanted marital relationship between two people, It is a thing of beauty, and it is an act of worship. And so as we get into this, what you will find is that the Bible is incredibly graphic, not crass, but graphic, about the beauty and the sanctity of marital love. And what always frustrates me is that biblically the word holy means set apart. And profane means to make common. And what we have done with sexuality is we've taken it from something that is holy and set apart for married couples, and we've made it something dirty and vile and profane. We've made it common. It's something that everyone participates in, either directly or indirectly through pornography or through the internet or through movies or through whatever it might be. And so as we get into this, what I would encourage you to do is to view this wedding night as a sacred act of worship done under the glory of God. Nothing is wrong here. But it makes us uncomfortable because we're so used to seeing sexuality as something that is profane that when we see it as something that's holy, it troubles us. It makes us a little uncomfortable. To be honest with you, some of the things here make me a little uncomfortable. But that just indicates that we all need a renewal of the mind. We need to rethink sexuality. That in the eyes of God, there's nothing improper when it's done within a covenanted marital relationship between a husband and a wife. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than wine, and the fragrances of your perfume than any spice. And where he says here, how delightful is your love, the word there actually means lovemaking. He tells her, it is going to be wonderful to be intimate with you. My sister, my bride. Being intimate with you is like a fine glass of wine. It's like the choicest of celebrations. It's the most pleasurable, wonderful experience I'm ever going to have. And the fragrance of your perfume is better than any spice. The way that your body smells when I hold you next to me, and I get to lie with you for the entire evening as friends and lovers, is the most beautiful fragrance I will ever smell. The fragrance of your lips drop sweetness as the honeycomb, my bride. Milk and honey are under your tongue. And so you see here, a Jewish couple is French kissing before France ever existed. And so they're kissing, and he's talking about how much he loves to kiss her and to be passionate with her, because to kiss her is sweetness itself. And so we see that kissing is a sacred activity. It's a spiritual activity. It's an activity that belongs to God. And so, friends, I would encourage you, even who you kiss is of great significance. There was a friend of mine in college. I had a course with him. He was a Christian. I was a brand new Christian. He'd walked with the Lord for a number of years. And I had a philosophy class with him, and he got engaged to a wonderful Christian woman. They have a wonderful marriage. They're great people. And he, in his entire life, had never kissed a woman, ever. And in class, we had to give position papers on some sort of philosophical or cultural or political issue. And so he chose chastity as the issue that he wanted to speak of. And he got up in front of the class and said, you know, I've never kissed a woman in my entire life. And the first time I ever kiss a woman will be on my wedding day. When the pastor says I do, I will. Right? And everybody laughed at him. And to be honest with you, as a new Christian, I laughed at him. I thought, well, isn't that a little idealistic? Isn't that a little legalistic? It wasn't out of a legalism. It was that to him, kissing was such a sacred activity, he wanted to kiss his wife and never know what it was like to ever touch the lips of any other woman. And now that I'm married, from this side, it's a good idea. It's a good idea. It's a nice thing to think, gosh, we're the only people we've ever kissed. For some of you, that's already not an option. But I would encourage you, watch who you kiss. It's a sacred activity. And someone asked him in that class, they said, well, if you haven't had sex all of this portion of your life, how do you know if she's going to be any good? And he said, I have never touched a woman. How will I know if she's bad? That made perfect sense to me. There's no one to compare your mate to. You've been single your entire life. Even a woman who isn't particularly passionate will be wonderful. It beats living alone. And then they asked him another question. He's a sharp guy. They said, well, look at all the sex you've missed out on. And he says, I'll get married and I'll catch up. So what we see, I think he had a biblical understanding. He wasn't a prude. He wasn't anti-intimacy. He wasn't anti-sex. He wasn't anti-enjoyment. He was just waiting until he got married. And then he was going to enjoy himself with his wife. And they've got a great marital relationship to this day. And I didn't mean to say this, but I would say this as well. How do you think that made his wife feel when he told her, honey, I have totally been able to control myself all of these years going into marriage? What do you think her level of trust is for that man? She can trust him. He's a man who has self-control and discipline. If someone can't control themselves sexually before they're married, what is to guarantee that they'll be able to control their sexual desires once they're married? The discipline and the character issues begin long before you say, I do. If you can control yourself beforehand, it won't be that difficult to control yourself after, because you live a disciplined life. And I think that's what we're going to see here tonight, is one of the reasons that this couple is going to enjoy themselves so much on their wedding night is because they are exploring an entirely new world that neither of them has visited. And so it's so exciting. And there's nothing dirty. The fragrance of your garment, Solomon says, is like that of Lebanon. And at this point, she's probably wearing some sort of negligee. She's dressed. They're now probably in their bridal chamber. She's dressed attractively. And he says that even the way she smells is just breathtaking. You ever been around? If you're married, you know what I'm talking about. The way that your spouse smells is something that's very unique. And to be with them, the smell. When I go out and I do speaking, or I'm on a trip or on a retreat, and I come home and I see my wife and I give her a hug and I smell her, there's something magical there. There's something very mysterious. It's a gift of God. He says this, you are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. What he means by this is this. He says, in the Middle East, water is a precious commodity. It's very difficult to come by. And so if you had a spring of fresh water in a desert area, around that spring naturally would grow a garden. There would be some foliage. There would be some plant life that would come from that fresh garden. And now anyone who saw that would know that in there is fresh water. And so lots of people would desire to come and to steal your water, the water that rightfully belongs to you. And so what the owner of the spring would do is he would build a wall to enclose and to protect his spring and his garden. Because that water doesn't belong to everyone. And only the owner has the right to come in and to enjoy the garden and to partake of the water. He says that she, listen to what he says, you are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. In a very elegant, poetic way, he's saying, you are a virgin. You are choice, beautiful, wonderful, fresh water. Life around you is a rich garden, and you have built a wall around yourself to protect yourself so that no one could come in and take the water that belongs to me. The beautiful thing here, and it's going to be hard for some of us to receive, is that some of us are single people who are a sealed spring. We put a wall around us to where sexually no one has come in and taken that which rightfully belongs to the person that we marry. Some of us have not guarded our spring very well. And lots of people may have come in and drank water from the well that didn't belong to them. It's sin. It's wrong. It's an offense against God. I can't say it nicely. It's a tragedy. But we know that in Christ there's also forgiveness. That it's never too late to build a wall around your garden. It's never too late to put a seal on your spring. And so what I would even ask you to do tonight, if you're here and you're sexually active, build a wall, seal up your spring. God will forgive. But go and sin no more. And if you've waited and you're here and you're thinking, I'm missing out. All of my friends are sexually active. I'm feeling lonely. Maybe I'm in my late 20s, early 30s. I'm frustrated. Keep the wall up. Maintain the seal on the spring. The kind of intimacy and love and pure pleasure that they enjoyed only came as a result of protecting what rightfully belonged one to another. And then it can be enjoyed fully. And so for those of us who come here with lots of people that have visited our garden and many people that have drunk from our spring, if you come to me for counseling for marriage, the first thing I'm going to ask you to do is sit down with your spouse and explain all of that before you get married. That the Lord has forgiven you and your spouse will have to forgive you. And there's forgiveness in Christ. I don't want to de-emphasize that. But I also don't want to make light of the fact that the beautiful thing about this wedding night is the fact that they are learning how to be lovers together. They don't know what they're doing, but together they'll figure it out. And that's the beauty of it. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits, with henna and nard, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, with myrrh and aloes, and all the finest spices. In calling her a plant and talking about her garden, spring, if you haven't picked it up yet, it's all ancient Near Eastern metaphor for a woman's genitalia. That he's saying that the way that she even smells as they are in bed together preparing for intimacy is wonderful and enticing. And he enjoys all aspects of sexuality with his wife. She's rare, she's exotic, and she's a treasure. Question, does that sound dirty? You don't have to answer out loud, but ask this in your mind. Does this sound dirty? If it does, there's a problem with our thinking. This is a husband and a wife. Normally what we're given on television and in movies and pop culture is that sex is only enticing and exotic and pleasurable when it's forbidden and you cross the line. And here we see that's just not the case. Solomon learned that lesson later on in life. But at this point, he's doing it God's way and he enjoys it. At the end of his life, with 700 wives, 300 concubines, 1,000 sexual partners, he writes the book of Ecclesiastes, and 38 times he says that life is meaningless. And so when he began the way that the Lord intended, he experienced great pleasure. When he abandoned the ways of the Lord, his sexual appetite was never fulfilled, and his soul was never filled. His life was empty, though his bed was full. You are a garden fountain, a well of springing, a well of flowing water, streaming down from Lebanon. Here, I think he's very clearly talking about the fact that after speaking to one another and being together with one another on this wedding night and having intimacy together, she is now prepared for lovemaking. Physically, she has now been aroused and she is prepared for the first time to have intercourse and to be with her husband. Up to this point, we've seen this recurring phrase that she says. What is it? She says over and over, do not arouse or awaken love before it's time. What does she say here? Awake. Awake. Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 3, there's a time and a season for everything. The time has come. This is the season for intimacy in marriage. Isn't that beautiful? Before, she's talking about her desires, and she say, don't awaken or arouse love before it's time. Don't arouse or awaken love before it's time. Here she says, awake. Awake. ladies, what she does here is she tells him that she is sexually aroused and ready for intimacy. What we see throughout the book is the key to intimacy, the key to romance, and the key to a good marriage is that a husband and wife speak very honestly with each other and talk about things that may be a little embarrassing or a little discomforting, but they talk, they're honest, so that they both know how the other is doing and how they can appropriately serve and love and care for one another. And so Solomon, even as a young man, his first time in the bedroom with his wife, has been patient, preparing her so that she is ready to be with him. She then speaks to him and tells him that she's ready. Wonderful dialogue. There's this great honor and respect that they have for one another. Awake, north wind, and come, south wind, blow on my garden, that its fragrance may spread about, that its fragrance may spread abroad. Let my lover come into his garden and taste its choice fruits. And so again, the garden is a metaphor. And what she's saying is, I love you. We're covenanted before God. We are married. And I want to be one with you. Scripture says that the process is to leave father and mother, be covenanted together in marriage, and then to become one flesh. They have done all of the rest, and now they become one flesh. She invites him in to make love to her, to be passionate with her. And she is so honest that she says to the degree that their lovemaking, that even the scent of that will fill the room with choice fragrance. And then he responds. This is after their lovemaking has ended, after their first intimate experience and the becoming of one flesh has occurred. Solomon says this, I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk. He's satisfied. He got to make love to his beloved. They've been together. And now he speaks to her and he encourages her by telling her how much he enjoyed being intimate with her, how much he cares about her, and how wonderful she is to be with in all ways, including the sexual. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that a beautiful thing? There's a little controversy with this last verse as to whom is speaking. Some commentators believe it is friends of the family. Seems a little odd. Let me read it, and you tell me who you think this might be. Eat, O friends, and drink. Drink your fill, O lovers. Who do you think that might be? That comes in and speaks after everything is concluded and gives just the crowning last word. I'll tell you who I think it is. I think it's God. I think it's God. I think only God would have known all of these activities. And I think what he's saying here, eat, O friends. They are friends. They are not just two people hopping into bed. They are a husband and wife who love each other and are friends. And one of the biggest problems that we've got is sometimes we don't view the bedroom as a place that friends go. It's a place that sexual partners accomplishing some sort of biological function go. Friends are the best lovers. The bedroom should be a place of joy and fun and wrestling and conversation, and it should be no different than the rest of life together. That if two friends are in bed and they're husband and wife, their friendship continues and sexuality doesn't need to be such a serious issue with massive guilt because we expect to live up to some standard that is not biblical that we see on television or in a movie. These are friends. He says, eat, O friends, and drink. Drink your fill, O lovers. Enjoy yourselves. Congratulations. I bless this. Guys, I believe that's God. I believe God looks down on the sacred activity and says, enjoy yourself. Congratulations. It's his gift. And he's given it, and they've used it appropriately, and he blesses as a result. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for your word. God, as we enter into worship, some of us know that we haven't done a good job of putting a wall up around our garden or putting a seal over our vine, over our well, our spring. For those people, God, I pray forgiveness and mercy and grace. I pray real repentance, not just guilty feelings. God, for those of us who are here that are single and hear some of this and it challenges our thinking and it really gives us a desire to be married, God, I just pray for grace for those people to be patient, to wait for the right person, not get married just for the sake of being married, but to find a friend and a lover to be covenanted together with before you. And God, I pray for our marriages that one of the hallmarks of this church would be husbands and wives who really love each other, that really talk to each other about difficult things, and together in secret have this wonderful, passionate, glorious relationship with one another and with you that is all their own, that is poetic, that is song, that in and of itself is altogether joy. God, we love you. We thank you for Christ. We thank you for Him dying and resurrecting to forgive us from the sins that we've committed, both in deed and thought, so that we might get back to Genesis 1 and 2 pre-fall, where Adam and Eve were naked with no shame. God, that's our prayer.